We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Hey guys, and welcome to What Was Her Name? The show where I will uncover the stories of domestic abuse survivors. I'm your host, Maya Hoover. Hey guys, and welcome to What Was Her Name? My name is Maya Hoover, and I am the host of What Was Her Name? Today I have my guest, Callie Porteous, is that how you say it?
Porteous, yeah, close.
Okay, darn it.
It's okay.
I am Callie, and I'm, really eager to hear your story. We've followed each other in the Instagram world for quite a while, and I always, have these random interactions with you, but I'm, I think I've said a couple of times, hey, can I get your story? Hey, I want to know your story. Hey, I want to hear your story. And so finally, it's just time to share it. And so I'm really looking forward to hearing it. And I'm just, really excited to have you on the podcast today. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I'm excited to be able to share my story and to be able to be on.
Yeah. Okay. So the place that I always like to start is, first, how long was the relationship?
Mm-hmm.
And how long was the relationship? When did you leave?
So the relationship was coming up on 10 years.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And I left when our son was 10 months old.
Okay.
So it was, it was a very long time before our son came into the picture. I met him when I was 18. So it was, basically the majority of my 20s.
Okay. Wow. Mm-hmm. And then, did you say when you left?
I was, at the time, 26, I would have been. And our son was 10 months old. So that was the time of year. I remember everything. It was September 2017.
Okay.
Yeah, 2017, 16. I might be mixing those up because again, 10 years, long time.
Long time. Yeah. Okay. Wow. You actually got married you left the year that I got married, the month.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Super weird.
Wow. It's amazing. I feel like there's a lot of, just when you start to talk to people within this community, there's so many synchronicities in that way. And just, connected.
Truly. Okay. So 10 years. And how did you guys initially meet?
So, I was in high school, so it was very juvenile, mutual friends introducing, and we met at a house party. And it was just at a time in my life where I was I had to make a decision about college. I wasn't doing well in high school. I was going through a lot of emotional, upheavals, a lot of issues with disordered eating that I wasn't, getting help for or talking about with anybody, and had a lot of just personal things that had happened in a really short period of time.
Right.
Some, darker things, sexual abuse that happened within my very first experiences, which then kind of pushed me towards him. He was a little bit older than me, which is, a theme. So, but only by 2 years, but still old enough that he was disconnected from, the friends that I had and this kind of toxic situation that was going on there.
Right.
And, I shared my vulnerabilities, and as they often do, he, took that, ran with it, did the classic love bombing, but again, in a very juvenile way. This was high school, essentially, even though he would have been 20.
Right.
And I just, he, in that moment, it didn't take much because I was in such a you know, vulnerable place in my life.
Right. Right. I think that's interesting how it makes perfect sense, but it's interesting as well that vulnerability is often the catapult to like making decisions where we are with somebody who then, whether it's intentional or unintentional, takes advantage of us in vulnerability. And I think that there are definitely people who are ill-intentioned who seek out women who are vulnerable to like manipulate them. And then there's also people who maybe it's unintentional, but there's still this often this common theme of a vulnerable state that you're in that leads to it. And not all the time, like it's definitely not like a, everyone is just vulnerable and this is just how it is. But yeah, I think that's just seems to be like a common pattern that I see is a lot of women feeling very vulnerable, often at a little bit of a younger stage in life where things are kind of in the air. I don't know what family home life looked like, but a lot of broken homes and, you know, this promise of the moon and then abuse.
Yeah. And just at a time in your life too, where you have to make so many serious decisions. And, you know, I'm somebody who I struggled and still struggle with dyslexia and other learning disabilities. So that made me even more vulnerable and have more self-doubt and just be, you know, in a position where it, like I said, it didn't take much for him to be able to kind of wrap me up into his world.
Right.
So at 18, basically right as I graduated, he had convinced me to not go to college and I stayed because I was also in a place where I was unsure what I wanted to do. And so I told my parents I was taking time, you know, to think about it. And I ended up very quickly moving in with him and his parents, actually, in their home, which is the state of the home that I was in. It's really hard for me to think about and to comprehend the fact that I willingly put myself there because I actually, like, I came from a family that was, my parents were divorced and they weren't perfect, but like, there was nothing, you know, that would have seemed like it would have pushed me into this place, but I willingly went and lived there. And his parents and their home that they had, they were, or I'm assuming they are still hoarders. And the home that they were in was and still is under construction. It's been under construction for over, at this point, I think almost 4 decades.
Wow.
And there was just so much toxicity there. And that whole, the home was very, the energy in the home was very dark. There was just a lot of just pain. And I am a very empathetic person. And so meeting my ex, he knew that. And he would tell me about, you know, what his life was like growing up and the struggles that he had. And I felt very deeply for him and felt that he was in a very sad and toxic situation. So I then wanted to like pour into him and give him what he never got as a child, but also willingly put myself in that same setting and situation. And did so also because he ended up, when I graduated, he knew that I loved animals and he had this Doberman puppy that he had for a while, but ended up being his dad's dog. So he surprised me and for my graduation got me a dog. And so it was, which seems crazy, you know, thinking back at 18, like, what am I don't even have a house. I'm so it was another thing that kind of catapulted me to move in to that home. And from that point, it was just a lot of, I mean, within his family, a lot of drug use, a lot of abuse that I witnessed, and just in a sense felt like I was on the outside because I didn't think it was happening to me because I witnessed their family and the toxicity within that. And I kind of felt like I was separated from it, even though I was so deeply in it. and being abused at that time, but not in a physical sense. It was, you know, psychological and emotional, and then very quickly it became financial as well. Mm-hmm. And just, yeah, progressed more and more as everything went on.
So initially in the beginning of the relationship, you said that he loved bomb you. What are some examples of like kind of just the character that you saw in the beginning when you first met him? Like, can you give me some examples of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, very just like basic things where I was giving him all of this information about me up front, about how I felt like I was, you know, rejected, or what I was dealing with my, you know, disordered eating, all this emotional kind of like ammunition. So he would say, oh, every day I'm going to tell you how beautiful you are, and I'll never, you know, let you feel like you're not. And I believed that and was like, wow, oh my gosh, this is okay. Like, I need that. I want that. I'm desperate for that. Right. So then that, just that little nugget, which didn't last long, that was about a month. And then it was the opposite of you're beautiful. It was every, you know, horrific thing you could ever think of that he started to call me. And at that point, you're so warped and you don't even really realize what's going on, and how to get out of it is just an impossibility, because you're so mentally just whiplashed. Nope. Essentially. And then beyond just like the, you know, him saying like that I'm beautiful and this and that, it was just like gifts, you know. He would show up to my, once I ended up getting a job after high school, he'd show up to my work and, you know, have a random gift. Like, he'd go to my favorite store in the mall and just out of nowhere. And he would also eventually do this too, because there were several times throughout these years that I attempted to leave, and he would try to win me back, which I guess to a degree it worked, through, you know, buying me things or just making me feel indebted to him.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like leveraging those insecurities is a big thing. And then using those very insecurities as ammunition to tear apart an individual, which also is like so interconnected with the vulnerability that you were talking about, because like initially, you know, being vulnerable, then feeling like it's a safe space to open up and share your insecurities. And then there's this person who's basically validating all the things that you feel are wrong, and then using those to leverage it against you. And when it's not like initially built and secured without that person's validation, then when they turn around and they use it against you, it's like, it creates this really sick dynamic where it's like, you, like someone is treating you really poorly, but then you're like, almost like you're like hungry for validation from the very person who's like mm-hmm. in that.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It was constantly seeking approval, validation, and living a life of just walking on eggshells, mm-hmm. waiting for the other shoe to drop.
When was the first time that you really realized and that thought crossed your mind, like, oh, something's not right here?
So early on, which is really hard to grapple with the fact that I was in this for so long with him, because it was within the first month, maybe even sooner. He didn't like that I had issues with these friends in high school, but they were mostly male friends. He told me that if I wanted to be with him, I couldn't be friends with them anymore. And at the time, the relationships with those friends were so complicated that in my mind, I was like, okay, this I'm not be friends with them anyways. Mm-hmm. So he's just supporting me and telling me, you know, this thing that's probably true, and I just need that push to do this. And so that was the first, you know, true indicator of him controlling my friend group. And then he would start to really try to come between my mom, and she and I have always had a really, you know, strong relationship. I'm her only daughter, and obviously every mother-daughter relationship has complications, but she's always been somebody who, you know, is my mom, but also like my best friend. Mm-hmm. So I started to pull away from her a lot more. And that was something that became alarming. And she, I have an aunt who works in social work, who I remember, my mom had reached out to her, and she printed out the abuse wheel, which I feel like you've probably studied that, maybe know it by heart by now. I know I've seen it a million times. It's just like the spectrum and different types of abuse. And I have this vivid memory of taking it and throwing it in the back seat of my car and just being so mad that they would even suggest that this person who loves me like nobody else does would be that way, but then also still having these feelings that this isn't right.
Right.
But still feeling like he loves me more than anybody else does. So those were, you know, the initial indicators, but then very, very quickly it became much worse because it was clear that he was abusing substances. His father was giving him his prescription to Vicodin, and he would, I remember him chewing it like it was candy and just being very unaware and uneducated and also afraid, not sure what to even do with that. But I, one of the points where I tried to leave him early on, it was because of the Vicodin use. And I remember telling him, like, you're like Jekyll and Hyde. Like, it just doesn't make sense. Like, you're one person one moment, and then you're somebody completely different. And I believed it was because of that. Mm-hmm. And he had told me it was because of that. So then he stopped, or so he said he did. Mm-hmm. And I chose to believe that. And so for a while, I just thought, okay, it was just this. And he's getting better. Things are getting better, which didn't last long. And there'd be really violent episodes where it wasn't physical in the sense that he wasn't like punching me or beating me, but he would become intoxicated. And there was one night where we went out to his friend's house, and we had all been drinking, and he got mad at me because I just lingered back a little too long talking to his friend's girlfriend. And I didn't leave right when he left quickly enough. So he left me there. And I had to find my way home, which it wasn't far, but it was, you know, we had been out drinking. I was really young and not used to anything like that. And by the time I had got back to his parents' house, he was what he used to call in that he was seeing red. So he was lashing out at everybody in the household. He was breaking things. He was just on another level. I remember being intoxicated and sobbing and feeling just completely like shocked, because it was the first time I really saw him. Just, I mean, he was in his mom's face, his father's face, like they were all, nobody could control him. And his sister, who was older, was there at the time. And she just brought me into the back room and laid me down on this bed and laid with me and like basically rocked me to sleep. As I was like in a panic attack. And the next morning woke up, and he had fallen asleep or passed out under his parents' van. He was throwing money at them, and like there was money all over the street. And he acted as if nothing happened. And they all did as well. And we just had to carry on and pretend it didn't happen.
Yeah, I think that's so the parents didn't acknowledge it at all.
They enabled him deeply. His father, from what I've over the years, he's an interesting person. Looking at him, you'd be intimidated right up front, but he's Southern. Mm. So he's got this charm about him that was endearing, but also disarming.
Right.
But he would say, you know, like, pardon my language, but it's like how they always say, it's like saying fuck you with a smile kind of thing. He would be saying something sweet and then not like, or saying it in a sweet accent, but he'd be saying something terrible. Mm. And you just have to kind of smile and take it. And so it took me a while to realize like the depths of his personality and the influence that he had over my ex and the dynamic he had, their whole family had, and just really how toxic that was. Because there ended up being a lot of loss. His sister ended up dying of a heroin overdose.
Mm.
His sister's daughter, who was his niece, his sister was older. She eventually died of a heroin overdose.
Mm-hmm.
And there was just, there's a lot of dark, deep-rooted pain that I believe the origin comes from the abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And it started, I think, before, you know, my ex, before his dad. I think it's something really deeply rooted within their family's system. And they wouldn't even know how to untangle it.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night, ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end,
what will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Yeah. Like, I'm gonna... So, so much there. just for a second to just move backwards. I thought it's really interesting that you said Seeing Red, because we had an episode... Actually, no. We didn't have an episode on this. This is just somebody that I was helping outside of podcast, but she had talked about the phrase... No, you know what? No, there's... I've heard that actually multiple times where someone... Yeah. That they've said they're seeing red. And I think I had an episode, I almost called it that. And I've heard that multiple times. I know that people who have anger and who struggle managing anger will explode. And then they say that they see red. Right.
Yeah.
But it's really like heartbreaking just to hear how like even you reverted to almost this like childlike nature of like needing to crawl in a ball, because it's like you just needed to be like almost like helped to sleep because it was like too much.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that a lot of people in this space, including myself, can really resonate deeply with. And I think it's something that, you know, we don't really talk about. Like, we're not going around to people and being like, hey, let's get coffee and let me tell you about that one time that I had a panic attack and I called the call, you know, but it's like very real pain and very real suffering. And those moments are etched in your mind like forever. And I remember still, you know, those moments where I grieved in a way and mourned in a way that I never have before. And I know that, you know, this is an example for you. And then I know that other people listening have those moments and those memories that they can think of where they're like, man, like, I'm so glad I'm not in that space anymore.
And those moments definitely came more regularly. And that it's interesting because that moment with his sister, I ended up years later when I was pregnant with our son.
Mm-hmm.
He was having an abusive episode and he had his own business and had employees that were at the house, and two of them actually were my cousins who were employed by him. And he was just losing it on me. And I was probably 7 months pregnant. And I remember going and hiding in the basement. There was a bathroom down there and just like concrete tile, like nothing fancy, just basement bathroom, and locking the door and just sobbing. And him, he would ridicule me for crying, you know, mocking me, calling me, you know, every name that he could think of. And in that moment, I was on the floor, you know, again, heavily pregnant, just holding myself in the fetal position, sobbing. And, you know, I like to consider myself a spiritual person. I'm a sensitive person. I didn't grow up in religion or anything like that. So I've always kind of, you know, not claimed that, but I have always felt deeply and spiritually and feel like energy. And I, in that moment, had this like overwhelming sensation that I could just feel his sister holding me and rocking me. And it was as if I was like really back in that moment. But instead of it just being me, it was me and, you know, my son.
Wow. How does it feel like talking about these things and like kind of like bringing them to the surface now? I know that you've dealt probably with a lot of it, but I mean, obviously first time in this space.
Yeah, no, it feels, you know, really good to talk about it. It's something that I've always felt for me, I had no other choice. Like I've always been as vocal as I've been able to be in a lot of ways. I think we know, you know, very deeply that we can become silenced and it's scary to speak out, but in every way that I could, I've always tried. I've leaned on creative writing to be able to express things in maybe a more obscure way that could, or coded way that couldn't be used in a court of law. But I feel like I have a personal mission. Like I've gone through this for a reason, and it's not to just keep it all inside and ignore it. I truly believe that talking about it is the only way that I can prevent it for my son. But not only that, every time I've shared anything, it's had an impact. And I've had even, you know, just, I worked at a yoga studio for years, and that's, you know, a pretty good place to be able to be open and be vulnerable. And that I had, you know, people come up to me and tell me that me even just sharing about, like I shared about panic attacks that I had. Mm-hmm. And it was while a student was having it, like an active panic attack, and I was able to help her, you know, regulate her system, just it, because I knew what that felt like. And then after that point, just us talking and, you know, being open about it, it's just all of these little pieces click, and then, you know, it does something, and that person takes that, and whether it's something that they've been personally affected by or they know somebody, it's just got this, you know, this effect that just, it keeps trickling down. And like I said, we're all connected. Mm-hmm. And I believe that we all have experienced or know somebody that has experienced abuse. Mm-hmm. And we live in a very abusive system and society. Mm-hmm. So the more that we talk about it, the more that we're able to implement and enact change, even in a very, you know, minute way.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so good. I think it's like really an important conversation that needs to be had. And like, it's really challenging and it can be really triggering, but it's also just a really special place to kind of like create a place to talk about these really hard things, that likely don't come up over dinner or coffee. So how did, being abused like start to manifest in your daily life? Like, are there maybe like one or two examples? I know there's so many.
Yeah.
that stand out to you where you're like, this was kind of my life for X amount of years, and this was kind of the pattern and like how that went for you?
Well, as far as like my career and work and all that, I was so limited because he controlled my life, where I wasn't able to build relationships, friendships. I was so isolated, and his family and that family unit, the way that they worked, it's, I almost, to be honest, you know, associate it with like a cult, because they're very, it's like a family cult. They're very intertwined. So I was kind of wrapped up in that and so isolated that I was only able to share a surface level of who I was with the outside world. So that was like the biggest hindrance, is that I just couldn't be the full expression of who I was. And then because of that, my routine, my life was so, you know, regimented, and just like, it was like Groundhog's Day at times. It's just the same thing, the same sad thing, and coming home and disassociating to try to just not exist in the reality that we were in. So like, I don't know, I'm sure you've watched the show Made that was on Netflix.
Well, there's,
yeah, there's this scene in the show where she's gone back and she's laying on the couch and in this like disassociative state where she just, it's a way that they film it too. It's really cool. She starts to like literally sink into the couch and just like, she's just falling into it essentially. And I had that feeling every day that like, I was just sinking into the couch, my mind almost like feeling like, if you've ever had restless leg syndrome, similar feeling where like your mind, everything is like screaming, your body can't move though, but it's like you feel like your skin is crawling, but you can't move, you just can't get up, and you're telling yourself, get up, get up, get up, get up, do something different, change, leave, but you're so just so stuck. So I was so stuck and so detached that my life became so small, where I had my animals and just like, you know, this little pocket, and it was good enough until it was not. And then, you know, towards before I became pregnant, that's when it was like, I was, you know, definitely suicidal and thought every day about a way out. And never with the intention, but just, how do I, like, I can't live like this. I have to get out. And then eventually ended up, you know, going to a doctor and talking to them about, you know, getting support in other ways, but which became a catalyst, you know, for a lot of things, me getting pregnant, but then a lot of clarity that came with that. And then from that clarity was, all right, like the motive, everything was kind of like falling into place. There'd be days where it's like, I need to get out still and like actually figure this out. Cause I just, it's, this is abuse. And I started really labeling it, and I started calling, you know, calling it out in the moment too, which became more dangerous as well.
And I think that that's something, you know, initially it, I think you said it was your parents that gave you the wheel, right?
My mom.
And like, when you're not ready to admit, or to like, not even admit, like there's a phase in a period where you do not recognize what is happening to you. It's very risky for somebody from the outside looking in to step in and say, hey, you're being abused. But there's like, when it's communicated in a certain way, like, I actually love that she gave you like a resource. And it was like something tangible that you could like have and see. And obviously you pissed you off and you threw in the back seat, but fast forward when you were ready. And unfortunately, I see this so often, and I know you do as well, is like people have to get to the end of themselves before they're ready to even like consider the idea of abuse. And
oh yeah.
So I think like even for people listening who may be in a situation where they're like, you know, I know someone who is in a toxic relationship, but I'm scared because I don't want to lose their friendship. It's like giving them the resources, but then also making sure that you let them know that you still support them. And it's not that you're supporting the relationship and you're being like, yeah, like this is the guy for you. Like he's great. But you're supporting the fact that you're like, okay, you need somebody who's going to be here to hold you when you're in a ball in a panic attack, or who is going to be here when you feel like your life literally is over and you rather have a car hit you than just be driving on the road to your grocery store. Mm-hmm. And like, that's not to say that that's everyone's position, because some people may not be in that space. They may not be able to, you know, emotionally be what somebody needs in that time, but there's still ways to support people, whether it's up close and personal or it's like over the phone, whatever it may be, while setting healthy boundaries in order to say, hey, this is what I think is happening. Here are these resources. I support you though. And there's no judgment from me that you stay, mm-hmm. because eventually they really do have to get to the end of themselves to realize that like they're being abused, and like it literally takes the unraveling, which is why we see so many women dying, because like you can't get through to them. And it's like the biggest fear, right, is that they're either going to be dead from that they're either going to get killed or they're going to commit suicide. And like it's, we see it all the time. And so I was just thinking about that and thinking about your mom, and I just can resonate with that very much.
Yeah. Yeah. And she had wrote me a letter apologizing, because I think I lashed out at her too. And like, I saved that letter. I've got it still, because it's just, it's sad, but it's also just her desperate attempt to like not fully lose me. And that worked, because she remained my lifeline. Like I still held on to them, but they also were continuously left in the dark about how bad it was. So they only knew the surface as well. Just as I said, you know, everybody at work, everybody, my whole life was just skimming the surface with everybody else, because if they truly got to know what was going on, like it's so, so dark. I mean, the things, and this just, again, like it would take me probably 20 episodes to get through the depths of everything, you know, and that's just even before our son came along.
Yeah.
But then the point where he comes into the picture, just even, you know, especially when I was pregnant, you know, as you know, that's where everything increases, the abuse increases, and usually the physical abuse, if it wasn't there before, and like a, you know, truly in a truly physical sense, you know, because he was physically abusive, but he would be like getting in my face and screaming. So I would justify that and say, he's not punching me. Mm. He's just not respecting my space or something like that. But that's physical abuse. So, you know, I become pregnant and these things are getting worse and I'm trying to hold them in, but it's like, you can see it. And this is something now when I see people, and you can almost identify the state of their relationship or like what's going on in their world, even if it's not their relationship, based off of their physical, you know, their face and their vibrancy. And I look at old photos of me and I just look just malnourished, depleted, or, you know, even if I wasn't thin, it was just like I was not healthy. And then when I was pregnant, I was so sick and struggling, and really I had just a really difficult pregnancy. And, you know, my mom, without her being there, without her like taking that approach, I definitely would not have survived that. And because I started to reach out to her more, and tell her a little, you know, a little bit more, a little bit more until, and I actually, once he was born, we left twice and I went back, and I know that I can't even imagine from her perspective what that felt like.
Yeah.
To have to be like, okay, you two are going back again. Because again, she didn't know the full extent. But, you know, it was me leaving and him chasing me and our son, who was a newborn, at high speeds in his truck down in multiple times. And me going to her house and saying, we just got into a huge fight, not saying I was just, you know, almost chased off the road with our infant son.
Right.
You know, just not telling her just enough so I could, you know, I didn't want to hurt her and hurt them. So just enough. But eventually it's like it becomes too much. And the point where I really knew, like, it was, I mean, there's so many points where I really knew that this was not going to be, I was not going to survive this.
Yeah.
But it was, our son, who had to be at the time probably 8 months old, and he was at his parents' house.
Yeah.
And I had been helping him with his company and working for him. And he lost it. We had just gotten home and he lost it over something. And just, I don't, it could have been, you know, I needed to pick up his boots and I just didn't do it quick enough. And he got in my face and was screaming and spitting on me and antagonizing me and telling me to like hit him and trying to get me to, you know, trying to get me to react and then claim it was abuse. And excuse me, I ended up pushing him and telling him to get out of my face. And there's a memory, just, you know, it was very foggy, patchy, but I remember being basically tackled down onto the recliner. It was like a leather recliner that he had in the living room. And he flipped it over. I was, you know, my back on the ground. He's on top of me on the recliner. And he's essentially trying to choke me to death is what I thought in my mind. I'm like, he's killing me because he was choking me and I couldn't breathe. And I had an 8 month old and he wasn't there, but I didn't, you know, you don't want to die. So I remember reaching up and thinking, I have to choke him. I have to hurt him, get him off of me, or else I'm going to die. And I just remember putting my hands around his throat. And then he had this smile and this look in his eyes. And then he took his throat and pushed it into my hand as hard as he could, smiling intentionally, trying to leave more marks around his neck or do something. And I don't remember how I got, like, I couldn't remember how I got out of that for years. I just blacked it out. I just remember that moment. And it was like this real, you know, on replay in my mind over and over again. And, you know, I'd have panic attacks a lot about that and feeling like the weight of him on my chest. But it wasn't till years later when talking to his, you know, my ex's other ex and about all the abuse that she endured, that she ended up relaying the story that his father had told her about, you know, basically telling her that it wasn't going to get better and that he knew about the abuse because he had to pull him off of me when he was choking me. And it was like, as soon as she told me this, it was like the scene in a movie where, like, you know, you're in an up close, you know, angle, and then all of a sudden it goes, pans out to a wide angle where you see the rest of it and it all just kind of makes sense.
Right.
And I remembered, oh, his dad pulled him off of me. And then not only that, but then withheld that information for years and then eventually would deny it because it was attempted. I mean, he attempted to kill me. And, you know, it always gets worse. And that wasn't the point where I left. We left 2 months later. I stayed. But I was so sure that I would be dying because of that. And the day that we ended up actually leaving, it was like just a regular day, except that we had all woken up sick. And it came down to him just throwing this, you know, tantrum again. I wasn't moving quick enough. He wanted me to essentially lock our baby in a room all day so I could just work and not have to deal with our son. And I refused. And he, you know, he would often take the car and take my phone. So I'd be stranded there with the baby and not have any way to get a hold of anybody really, other than at the time it was Facebook Messenger. So I went on the computer and messaged his mom and told her I needed her to come get us. And she did. And then eventually I think I messaged my mom and said, I need her to come get us from his parents' house. And she did. And that was, we never went back. Or I mean, I never went back. No.
Yeah. It's honestly just like, I think I can resonate with this. And I know like a lot of people here can, and obviously all of our stories are so different, but there's just so much that's intertwined here. And I can just like imagine how scared you must have felt in that time. And having to kind of like share, you just kept saying just enough. You shared just enough, just enough. Mm-hmm. You said that so many times in repetition. And I thought that was like super, yeah, I would say like profound, just because I really like that phrase, because I think just enough is kind of like a big, I don't know, statement. Whether it's like, you know, there was like just enough abuse where he didn't like, he was like screaming in your face, but he like hadn't hit you. Right. Or, it's just enough, where he didn't drive you off the road, but he tried to drive you off the road. Like he was you know, racing after you. And you tell just enough information, but you don't share too much, because I think there's, I don't know what it was like for you. I know for me, I experienced like shame, like even word abuse out loud was like, so like, whoa. And sharing the things that he would do, it's like almost like you're protecting this partner and you feel the weight of the embarrassment of the behavior that they have, while also trying to protect their like reputation for people to not see them a certain way. And it's like their crap that you are protecting, and it just like eats you alive. Like you feel like you literally can't be like, you just, I don't know, it's like, I think everybody desires to have human connection and vulnerability. Even if people say that they're not like very vulnerable individuals, we all desire human connection. We thrive when we are vulnerable with others. And when you cannot be vulnerable and you're sitting at a table with somebody or with somebody and you're carrying the weight of like an abusive relationship and you're sharing like just enough, it is like the worst feeling. I remember that feeling, and just, it was awful. And it was so freeing when I could finally like say this. And so it's like so crazy that like at one point it was just enough communication to get by, and now you're like on a podcast sharing your story of abuse. Like, just so wild, you know?
I know, it's been a really wild journey, because, you know, it's before we talked, I was talking to my friend and I'm like, how do I even digest, you know, where do I begin? Like, because there's the 10 years of just he and I, and then our son comes into the picture, and there's the initial, you know, post-separation. There's like, there's a lot of abuse in that first family court. And then it's like, you know, it goes on and on and on. And there's, you know, we had trial custody, and there's, like I said, it could be a 20 episode podcast with the amount of just the amount of stuff, the amount of abuse and toxicity and pain. And we, you know, it's hard to really figure out where to start, but I think, you know, I just know my mom is a huge piece of all of this. And I think like the message that is one of the messages that I do want to get across is if it's not your mom, it's, you know, maybe your coworker or your friend, or, you know, like I said, I wasn't allowed to have friends. So it could just be your coworker. Giving those people, whoever, just enough. That could be your lifeline.
Right.
You know, it could literally save your life. And keeping my mom enough in the loop saved my life in so many different ways. And I'm sure, you know, if you had her on here, she would say, well, you should have told me more. I would have done more. And, you know, I wish I could have, she still wishes she could have done more, wishes she could do more, but, you know, you have to go through it. Like you said, you have to, as an individual, go through everything and come undone and then figure out how to put yourself back together. And that has been a huge piece of all this. And I'm not, I'm not fully together. There's so much growth and, you know, there's so much life and just purpose left to live. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of, you know, struggles. And I still, you know, there's no resolution in our court case. We're still just in limbo, but it's a little bit safer of a limbo right now.
Right.
But it's, you know, even in family court, it's each time we're like, well, how is this, you know, what is going on? How is this not being resolved? Like, how are they not seeing this? And it's something where, like, you know, again, my mom, she would always lean on, like, well, you have him now, it's temporary, but each day means each day is better than, you know, not having him, and that we can, it will make the difference. The more time, the better. Time is on our side right now. Time is on our side. And it's the same thing. It's like, I don't have that permanent resolution. You know, I don't have my justice fully. And I desire that deeply. And our son deserves that. I deserve that. But we are in a position, you know, that's, I know, is more privileged than other people because he's with me and he's safe right now. And I can protect him right now. And I've done that to the best of my ability, you know, thus far, despite it all. Or maybe because of it all, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like, yeah, adding kids in the mix is a whole nother realm.
Yeah.
And it's hard and scary and also really brave. What is something that you feel like you can do now that you couldn't do then, that you look at and you're like, whoa, this is like, even if it's something so minimal, I can do this now. And back then I, you know,
I can go out and dance. That is so silly and simple. And like, I don't know, I can go out and like, not feel like I'm being monitored and controlled and not dancing for anybody. Like I can go and just be free and dance. And it's so silly and meaningful though, because it's, you know, I didn't get that freedom.
No, I don't think it's like silly at all. I remember one time I was dancing in the kitchen and just being silly. And my ex-husband looked at me with such a disdain. Like he was like, I remember he turned to me and he was like, I didn't know that you were going to be like this.
And I read that, that noise. I'm like, and I remember just being so ashamed. And then I remember a time when I left, like maybe it was like 2 years later, I was in the kitchen with our kid and I was dancing and we were dancing together and just being silly. And it's like, I get to do this now.
My son and I, we have been doing kitchen dance parties since he was a baby, busting out the pots and the pans. And now we've taken our show on the road and we do our car dance party and air guitar and he's usually air guitar. I have to be the drums. So, but he'll let me be the lead air singer sometimes.
I love that.
Yeah. So, you know, and that's for him too. There's freedom that he has in his self-expression that he didn't get when he was going there every weekend until he was four. And there's a lot of abuse that he endured and witnessed. And so now to see him and he gets to experiment with his self-expression and, you know, his sense of style without his dad, like telling him that he has to take that off or, you know, shaming him for whatever it is, you know, maybe just dancing. He gets to do that. He gets to be whatever version of himself he wants to be, not who his dad tells him he needs to be.
Right. Yeah. What are your visions and dreams moving forward? What does life look like for you right now?
Oh my gosh. Life right now is all about stabilizing. You know, I've been in such a one day at a time, fight or flight, not being able to just like live in the moment and ground and experience life truly. Because I've been like preparing for everything that's coming. So my dream is to not have to be hypervigilant every single day and to be able to, you know, live life in a way that feels light and free, but stable and grounded at the same time. So kind of a, you know, contradiction, but truly just wanting for my son that sense of like stability and groundedness, but also that ability to have freedom in his self-expression, and the same for me. So as far as like how I envision that manifesting, you know, I am really invested in progressing in my career and, you know, making that, you know, our foundation. And then in the long term, just investing in my creative side and expressing that in whatever way that comes out. But I think like eventually getting more in or back into creative writing. And my long-term goal and dream would be to be able to write, you know, a book and then potentially screenplay and eventually movie. And, you know, it's something I just feel kind of every time I think about it, I get like full body goosebumps. And I just take that as an indicator that this is, you know, whether it's when I'm, you know, 50 or 70, whatever it is, I think those will be, you know, those will be things that I'll say are accomplishments of mine personally.
Yeah, I think about that all the time, especially as What Was Her Name's growing. And I hear all these stories and I'm like, man, like a documentary or like some sort of like even, I don't know. I don't know what is in store, but I just think that like there are so many stories that should be captured, and Made was like such a good Netflix piece because it embodied like abuse. And I watched that and I wept. I was like, oh my gosh, like when she sat in the train, I think it was like the train station. Kid at nighttime, it reminded me of like when I had fled and I was sitting in the airport, and I remember like every flight possible was getting canceled. And I was like, oh my gosh, like I'm never going to get out of here. And
Like my body was like so tired from all of the abuse that I literally couldn't carry our kid in the airport because I had like so many things and I was so tired. And I remember this woman, she like came up to me. She was on my plane that had gotten canceled and she was like, "Can I carry him for you?" And she walked with me through terminal after terminal in Frankfurt, Germany. And she spoke English. She was from America and she just carried my kid. And then like when we finally got to the final destination, like through customs, we had to get our bags because we had all gotten deplaned. And when I, you know, I needed to get my bags, which was like right nearby. It was like right, you know, just one little thing over. And she was like, "Go get your bags. I'll wait here." And I was like watching Lee, but then I like turned my back to grab my bag. And when I looked back, a flight attendant had Lee. And I came back and I was like, "Where's that lady?" And she was like, "What lady?" And oh I was like, goodness. "Where's the lady that was carrying my kid?" And she's like, "What lady?" Like she like didn't like, it was like they were busy. So I'm like, I was like, did she like just leave or like, you know, but she just kind of like, "Here's your kid." And then just like, that was kind of it. And I remember looking around because I'm like, why would she just leave? And like, was that an angel? Like, mm-hmm. what was that? And then like the next morning on the flight, I looked for her. She wasn't there. And I always count it as like my angel as what I call her. But I remember just like the Maid Netflix series, and it's so perfectly depicting abuse and thinking like there needs to be more stories like this, and they're captivating, they're real, and they're very raw and help us to like resonate and relate. And so I think that's super cool. And like, I'll be praying for that. Cause I mean, you see Netflix, I feel like is in a lot of different sources are airing stories of women's like stories of abuse or like just like really personal, mm-hmm. hard things. And so yeah, I don't know, definitely is possible, and writing is more than possible, you know.
I think so. I think it's interesting because I've recognized that as my, you know, abuse story kind of began to evolve and become, you know, a custody battle and all of this stuff in the media, I started seeing it everywhere, and it has been becoming more and more exposed, whether it's through, you know, celebrity trials and, you know, or you know, tragedies that we see, you know, happening every day. Mm-hmm. It's being exposed and being brought out into the open. And that's something too, where it validates that this is part of my life's purpose. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that I deserved that abuse or like I'm not grateful. I wish it didn't happen. But it did. And I know that I can do something with that. I don't have to let that become my ruin. Mm. I can't at this point because I've come too far. And so this will be, you know, something that I have not only survived, but I really truly believe that there's potential to save so many lives through not just sharing my story, but sharing other people's stories and exposing these, you know, instances of abuse that are so prevalent and happen every single day. And it's the only way that we can create change.
Yeah. Yeah. I could not agree more. Man, I'm super grateful for you just like joining me today and just hearing like a bit more of your story and holding it in this space is like genuinely such an honor.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, no, I'm super grateful. And yeah, it's just a really wild journey to connect with so many different women in this space and coming on a note. We're already on 2 years now, and it's just an honor to like, I don't know, because it's like what you experienced isn't in vain, and people will come across like your story, and there will be parts of your story that hit people really deep, and they're going to be like, oh, this is what I, you know, experienced, or, oh, well, that's weird. This is like something that my, you know, person does, but like, I mean, I wouldn't think chasing me down the road is abuse. I just would think he was just mad, you know? And like, oh, well, he says he sees red sometimes, but like he had a really bad childhood. So, you know, and then it's like, they start to kind of navigate that journey. And like, I've seen so many women come through Instagram and be like, man, I found your podcast. And like, it's not even like my, because it's like literally like, I feel like it's like all of our podcasts, because it wouldn't be a podcast without everyone's stories. So it's not even my thing. I'm just here letting everyone speak their stories. And so it's like people come across the story of our podcast and they're like, dang, I, you know, totally resonate with this person. And it's because of this person's story that I got out. And I'm just glad to have your story here, because I know that that is something that people will relate to, and it's never in vain. And yeah, I'm glad that we talked today and finally like got to have a conversation, because we've just always known each other through Instagram. So
I know. I agree. I'm so glad we're able to finally do this. And I really hope that, you know, I'm sharing my story is able to help anybody. And I also hope that through sharing too, you know, I want to just reiterate the importance of, you know, as a survivor, as somebody who's gone through abuse, that we remind ourselves every day that it's not our fault. And those people, just because it's, you know, being in something for the duration that I was in, you can definitely sit there and think like, you know, all the things, why didn't I leave? You know, blaming yourself for all of it, for accepting it. But the issue is the abuser and them actively choosing to abuse their victims every single day. And so I hope that, you know, anybody listening just knows that it's not their fault. It's not our fault. And that they just have to keep pushing through, because there is a day where you'll know. And like that exit sign will just be glaring in your mind and you'll know.
Right.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, no, of course. Yeah, I like do the graphics, and I'm like so excited to make your graphics, because I'm like so much like vision and like from your story. And like, I'm already just like thinking about your title, and like, I'm like, ah, this just, I just love bringing these things to life.
I know. I'm so excited. Yeah. Thank you.
All right, guys. So tune in Thursday this episode, we're recording this the day before, because it's me and I am just all over the place. And so tomorrow the episode airs. And yeah, I'm excited to have it airing. If you could do me a favor and just go to Spotify, it literally takes 1 second to just rate the podcast. If you go to Apple Podcasts, if that's what you use, writing a review and rating it, it actually boosts the podcast so that more people can like see the podcast. And it just opens doors for more stories to be heard, for this to grow into something more. And it literally just takes a couple of minutes. So it would really help me a lot. I'm super grateful for all the people in this space, and yeah, love you guys.